Stephen King for appellant, James Glenn Gray. I'm going to focus on my points 4 through 7 today without waiving points 1 through 3. This case is an appeal from James Glenn Gray for a conviction arising out of a felony murder. It has to do with his connection and role in an shooting death of two individuals over a drug deal. James and his brother were with their co-defendant, Stephen Ashford, for a few days in a house that they shared with their parents doing drugs. They ran out of drugs. Ashford said, "I know where to get some more. Some guy owes me." They go over there. They've got walkie-talkies. It's clear, at least in one of the statements that the appellant gave, that they were going over there to get some drugs, and if they weren't going to give it willingly, they would beat him up for them. It turns out that when they get there, Ashford goes inside and he shoots the two individuals in the apartment and has the appellant standing at the stairways with his brother in the getaway car, if you will. He has the appellant come into the apartment, help him grab some stuff. They leave. Well, that gun that was used came from James Glenn Gray's house that he shared with his brother and his parents. The sole issue for our case, for our argument on appeal, is did James Glenn Gray know that a weapon, a deadly weapon, was going to be used? If he did, then our appeal fails.
Used or taken along?
Both, Your Honor. Because if he knew that it was being taken along, then the case law is pretty clear. He's good for everything that's going to happen as a result of that. It should be reasonably anticipated that a murder could happen,
What is your position that the record reflects was the first time that Gray saw Stanford with his father's gun?
If you believe, well, just to answer your question directly, it is after the shooting. Now, that comes from a statement that statement comes from James Glenn Gray to the police officer. Now, the jury was free to believe that or not, but that's what his statement is. He says that they spent time together doing drugs. They go over there. In his first statement, he never even mentions the weapon. In the second statement, he says, "Well, I showed him the weapon." Because we were talking about his days in the Army shooting, and we're talking about the fact that my family hunts and so forth. And excuse me, but I think actually the record may be completely devoid on your question. I think I'm confusing a point where I called the appellant's father to testify to some hearsay statements, and I think that's where that came in. The jury did not hear that part, okay? And that statement to him was, "I never even saw that gun until after the shooting, and he's waving me up." So the jury actually doesn't have any evidence in front of them as to when he first saw the gun. What you have is the weapon is found at the Gray's house in an unlocked cabinet in a master bedroom that belongs to the appellant's father. But appellant and his brother Michael have access to that room. Okay? So a few days before this incident, they're doing the drugs and so forth. If you believe his statement to the police, he shows Ashford the gun. If you don't, then all you really have is that they found the gun later where Ashford said it would be. Ashford also told the police officer to go to that house because there were two other individuals involved in the crime there. He's referring, of course, to James Glenn Gray and his brother Michael Gray. So what you have is if they intended to go beat them up and get their drugs, if they didn't give it willingly, you have a robbery. If you have a gun that's knowingly being taken along, then you have an aggravated robbery, which can lead to the felony murder. My position is that just like in Tippett, that this court has heard before, where you had an agreement to go rob someone. It was a marijuana dealer. They were going to go rob him. And the defendant in that case is sitting in the living area when the co-defendant pulls out a gun and just starts shooting the victim in that case. The court ruled there's no evidence that there was an agreement that there was going to be a murder or that he even knew anything about a gun with regards to law of parties. Now, later, I think that came back, that was remanded and came back, and the court found that because they were running buddies with this guy and he had a reputation for carrying a gun, they found that, well, he should have reasonably known there was going to be a gun. And that was under 702B. We are under 702A, strict law of parties, and they've got to prove each and every aggravating element, which includes knowledge that the gun was going to be used. And in that regard, I have cited Rodriguez in my brief, and I think that is a very good case of a man goes into a convenience store while the appellant, or the defendant in that case, stays out in a getaway car. The defendant in that case says, hey, I didn't know he was going to pull a knife on them. So he's charged with aggravated robbery. He says, I'm just sitting there sleeping. He says he's going to go get a few things. Well, the jury convicted him of aggravated robbery. So they found that he was lying. The court said, hey, you may have found that he was lying, but there's still no evidence he knew a knife was going to be used. And the thing about this case is it's like that box we learn of in law school that's got that hole in it. And that hole here, for reasonable doubt, when you put the mouse in, right, and the cat goes in and you know, you open the top and there's no mouse, well, then you find there's a little hole in the box. And that hole is that here we know that Ashford himself had access to the gun. Everybody that would have been in that house could, because it's in a bedroom kept unlocked and he's there for a few days. Also, the appellant's brother would have had access to that gun, and there's no direct evidence that the appellant provided that gun to Ashford. In the state's brief, they point to Goodman and say, well, look, just because you have competing theories doesn't mean that the state's theory has to fail. If you can infer their theory, then the state can win. You have to uphold it under sufficiency of the evidence. But Goodman points out a hypothetical drug case where someone is just sitting a few feet away from some drugs. You can infer that he possessed the drugs. You can infer that, but it's not sufficient evidence to find beyond a reasonable doubt that he possessed it. I think you have the same thing going on here. You can infer from the evidence that, yes, the appellant must have provided that gun to Ashford, but that's not the kind of evidence that is sufficient to find beyond a reasonable doubt that he agreed to participate in an aggravated robbery and therefore be liable for felony murder.
What about the fact that he was aware that violence could occur?
That leads to a robbery case, and I agree with that. But the court's charge in that case and their whole theory in that case was he was participating in an aggravated robbery case with a deadly weapon, to wit, a firearm. That's what their theory of the case was, and that's what was submitted to the jury. So just because some violence could have been done, that doesn't transfer, that doesn't bootleg you up to you're liable for an aggravated robbery with a deadly weapon.
All right, let me ask you this. In order to get a deadly weapon finding, the defendant has to know or should have known a deadly weapon was going to be used. Is that right?
Should have reasonably known.
Okay.
The case law, I would say.
Is that right?
Yes.
Therefore, in order to have an aggravated robbery with a deadly weapon, to attribute the deadly weapon part of the aggravated robbery, the only thing that makes the robbery an aggravated robbery to the defendant, does the same rule apply, that he has to know or should reasonably have known that a deadly weapon would be used?
Yes.
Okay. So the portion of criminal responsibility for the acts of another, which I do not agree is the law of parties, the second part of it, B, says that if the only difference is a different offense is committed, you still have to plug in the deadly weapon requirement of knowledge, right?
Yes.
You're telling us?
Tippett was very clear on that. Okay. First of all, my position would be 702B doesn't apply, but even if it did, Tippett's very clear and has a very good discussion of that, that you still have to be put on notice reasonably that a deadly weapon is going to be used even under 702B.
All right. If I have an open liquor cabinet in my house and somebody's in my house for a few days and I toss them the keys to somebody else's car and say, hey, go out and drive this car over to somebody's house, or take me over to somebody's house. Okay, I'm a party to unauthorized use. Am I a party to DWI because I have an open liquor cabinet and the person may or may not have been drinking?
I was looking for an analogy all morning. That is perfect. No, I mean, you could make that inference that, hey, you should have at least reasonably been aware. You can make that inference, but can you make it beyond a reasonable doubt? And the answer is no.
Okay, that's...
See, I'm close to out of time. Are there any more questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. Ms. Kennedy? Ms. Kennedy, would you address the first three points of error raised by the appellant? That is, that this hearsay statement that the appellant contends falls in the excited utterance exception was improperly excluded.
Sure. In fact, late last year, the Court of Criminal Appeals in the Walter case, that's 267 Southwest 3rd at 885, Judge Cochran set out really definitively a good discussion of when a defendant's inculpatory and exculpatory statements are admissible as exceptions to the hearsay rule. And in fact, all the exceptions to the hearsay rule are meant to counter four basic premises about out-of-court statements. Faulty memory, faulty perception, opportunity to fabricate, and motive to fabricate. So if you can remove those impediments to the out-of-court statement, they're admissible, despite the fact that they're hearsay. And in Walter, and then this court again in Davis, said, you know, those last two, the opportunity to fabricate and the motive to fabricate, are so prominent in a defendant's out-of-court exculpatory statements that they are just generally not admissible. And I think that's the situation we have.
But... The appellant is claiming a specific exception, excited utterance. The state doesn't really respond to that directly in its brief. And you tell us why this is not an excited utterance, or why, even if it is an excited utterance, is that what you're saying, that even assuming this is an excited utterance, it's not admissible under the recent ruling of the Court of Criminal Appeals?
Right, and that's what I think the Allridge case initially came to, is that under the common law was the old kind of res geste. And when you look at the cases that talk about excited utterance, when it's the defendant's statements, they all kind of come under that general heading. And the state's argument is that because those last two exceptions that would make it reliable as an exception to the hearsay rule aren't present, except in extraordinary circumstances, courts do not admit out-of-court exculpatory statements of the defendant. You know, they're not a statement against penal interest. They're not a statement that would subject the defendant to embarrassment, so they don't have those indicia of reliability. What you have here is you have a passage of fairly significant time between the crime and the statements. You have a news report, and you can certainly interpret the father's offer of proof to be that I talked to my son about this, and there's no evidence about the other son. We're just talking about this defendant. He began to cry. Well, it's equally reasonable to think that he was crying because he was confessing his complicity in murder to his father, as it is to infer.
There is, do we have a double standard here? If it's the victim, then that's an excited utterance? Because I remember a specific case where there was a television program where the little girl started crying. And
that was much longer after the crime. You're right.
Yeah, and I wrote that that was an excited utterance. But we're saying that if it's a defendant who starts crying, it's not an excited utterance?
Absolutely not, because in this case, we're talking about an exculpatory statement. You've got the motive and the opportunity to fabricate. And that's the big difference.
Well, but we've an excited utterance is supposed to be a spontaneous response to something that doesn't give you time to filter it through your brain. It just comes out.
Mm-hmm.
It's an excited utterance. It's not something you think about. And yet we have held that watching a television program that causes you to start crying and say, am I going to get pregnant? Am I going to get pregnant? Is an excited utterance. We have held that a written statement at a police department is an excited utterance if it's a victim. So you're saying that a defendant who makes a written statement at a police department, if he's upset, did he seem upset to you? Seemed upset. She seemed upset to me. Was she crying? She's crying a little bit. Is an excited utterance. Are you saying that a defendant who seems upset, is crying a little bit, is not making an excited utterance if a victim is?
I don't know. It depends on the facts in that case.
Haven't we gone astray with an excited utterance?
But I understand your argument to be that this may, assuming this is an excited utterance because it's an exculpatory statement, that it would not.
The indicia of reliability that you usually look to when you're looking at an excited utterance, or when there's an inculpatory statement, that kind of old-fashioned res gestae statement made, they're just not here in a case when the defendant makes a self-serving hearsay statement and then tries to backdoor that in through another witness.
So this Court of Criminal Appeals opinion that you've cited us, you think will answer this question definitively?
Yes, I do. Now, interestingly, Walter on the facts looks like it doesn't come down because they say the defendant's inculpatory statements should have been admitted. But if you apply the Walter analysis to this case,
exculpatory?
No, inculpatory.
Okay.
Inculpatory.
So you admit an inculpatory, but you exclude an exculpatory.
Absolutely, because we're back to Judge Cochran's analysis about the reason we admit we have exceptions to the hearsay rule. The reason that hearsay becomes admissible is because you've eliminated these four categories of events. And the state's argument here is that the passage of time and the confrontation by his father gave him sufficient opportunity to reflect and to shade the facts in his favor.
But a victim
then it wouldn't be an excited utterance under that analysis.
Right. Frankly, the trial court in his ruling addressed the excited utterance by exactly the same facts I'm addressing to this court. And it was clearly not an abuse of discretion to say, too much time had passed. The circumstances of the statement where you're confronted by your father with, do you know anything about this? Just didn't make it an excited utterance.
If it had been offered as a prior inconsistent statement after they offered his written statement, it would be admissible, wouldn't it?
Are you talking about the rule of optional completeness?
No, I'm talking about a prior inconsistent statement.
But it wouldn't be inconsistent with his written statements, and that leads me to why this court doesn't have to open this can of worms at all.
Wait a minute, it's not inconsistent with his...
No, his written statement said exactly the same thing he said to his father. So they were entirely consistent.
Prior consistent statement.
Right, and since those written statements were admitted, why should we have to discuss this at all, since they were admitted elsewhere in the record?
Was there evidence of the search warrant? You know, the fact that they had a search warrant based on the father's affidavit, because often
I believe the only thing. I believe the only testimony elicited was based on the conversation. Did the police come out? Yes. And then there was the testimony from the officers about not only finding the gun that was used, but also finding a knife in appellant's room that was consistent with injuries to one of the victims.
So the state offered, was it the state or the defense who said, as a result of the conversation with your son, did the police come out?
That would be the state. But just because the word conversation was mentioned does not open the door. The state didn't rely on anything that was said.
I thought it was the basis of their affidavit. It was the basis of the
affidavit. It would have been, but the jury never heard that. The jury never heard what the basis was. The jury just heard based on the conversation, and there is a plethora of case law that says mere mention of a conversation doesn't include the contents of the conversation.
Doesn't the defendant have the right to challenge
yes,
the search or the arrest?
But
so if
didn't.
He had, then the affidavit would have come in and it would have made the statement.
Possibly. Admissible. Possibly. But that's not the facts of this case.
Right, okay.
All right, let's get to the knowledge of the this time. You make a statement that appellant properly offered him his appellant's father's gun.
Yes.
I don't believe that's in the record that I could find. It says, it's certainly not in these three places, reporter's record, state's exhibit, or defense exhibit, that I could find. The only thing that I could find was that it said that he saw him with the gun. Nothing about he offered him with the gun. Do you have something in the record for us, your position, as to when Mr. Gray was aware that Mr. Stanford had the gun?
May I have the opportunity to do a supplemental brief? Because I don't have it in my notes.
Yes, I'd like to know when Mr. Gray had knowledge that Mr. Stanford had the gun. Most importantly, did he know he had the gun before they went to get the drugs?
Okay. The state would like the opportunity to address where specifically that is, but even if it's not specifically in the record,
all right.
The jury could have made that reasonable inference.
How?
My recollection is that in one of this defendant's statements to the police, there was a discussion between the two brothers and Ashford, the shooter, regarding this guy cheated me. Mm-hmm. And it was in relation to that discussion, this guy cheated me, and I'm going to get him. I'm going to get even with him, that the gun was exposed to Ashford.
Okay.
But that's just my recollection, and I will be happy to provide you with sites that support that. I think the jury could have reasonably inferred that a discussion about obtaining drugs in which one of the conspirators was shown a weapon, according to the defendant's own statement, mind you, that it was reasonable to infer that the defendant was minimizing the provision of the gun into a mere exposition of the gun.
Well, do you agree that Gray had to know or should have known that Stanford was taking a gun to get the drugs, to get where you need to be? What's your position that the state has to show with respect to Stanford having the gun when Gray went with him to get the drugs?
He a reasonable person, reasonable, yes, it's the reasonably should have known standard.
Knew or should have known that Stanford
knew or should have known, yes.
Okay, but in your brief, counsel, it seems more clear than what you're saying here in argument.
Good.
Well, so I'm sitting here wondering, okay, which is true? No, I'm not suggesting that you've misrepresented anything, but at page 7 and 8 of your brief, you refer to Reporter's Record, Volume 3, State's Exhibit 106, and Defense Exhibit 7, multiple times in explaining that after Ashford complained to appellant that he was cheated by Kevin, appellant promptly offered him his father's gun. And then you go on to explain that Ashford took the gun provided by appellant, and while appellant stayed outside, shot and killed, etc. So
you know,
that doesn't leave any doubt in my mind regarding this issue, but
And the state readily concedes there is no direct evidence on this point, but there is a constellation
on the point of what?
Of whether or not Gray knew there was a gun. or provided the
okay,
gun.
Okay, but in your brief, and we'll just have to read the record, but you say the record shows that appellant offered him the gun.
Right.
And that he took the gun that was offered and shot him.
And the sequence is that they went to get the drugs then.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm saying. I read the record, and it doesn't say that. But you're going to provide us a supplemental something
you're
to
gonna
establish that.
I certainly hope so. But
or back off of what
as,
you said.
As I said, it doesn't. You don't really need to get there because of the constellation of other evidence. You know, if you look back at this court's opinions in the Turo case, there was no direct evidence of murder. You had someone found with a dead body who claimed from the moment they got out of the water that the victim drowned. But there was a constellation of other evidence was inculpatory.
But the gun offered, did Mr. Gray offer the gun? Is that in the record?
I am sincerely going to research
okay.
that.
You
thoroughly.
May want to amend your brief to correct some of these
and,
statements.
And if he didn't offer the gun, the state still doesn't think it renders the evidence insufficient.
Well, we don't know.
Brief,
we'll wait to see what you
off,
say.
Then let's back off and say yes, but.
Okay. Well, that certainly
it doesn't say that, but. And let's focus on how you think you're going to get there without the direct evidence, because this is pretty direct, what you put in your brief.
Right.
He offered him the gun,
right.
And then they went to get the drugs.
Well, right.
If that's not so, we're kind of dealing with a different situation.
Okay, well, then that will certainly be clarified.
Okay, good.
Thank
and
you.
He
Thank
wasn't, just to be clear, he wasn't charged as a co-conspirator, right, under the conspiracy statute?
No, he was charged as a guilty as a party.
Guilty as a party,
mm-hmm.
rather than a co-conspirator. So there's a difference there.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Kennedy.
Thank you.
Mr. King.
Certainly.
You're not satisfied with our rebuttal? You think
enough?
You can add to it?
Well, I'm not going that far.
Okay.
But I would say that the record is devoid of that particular line of he provided him the gun. It's not there. It didn't happen that way. It just didn't. And I think the cases are pretty clear that you do have to have that knowledge when you're dealing with 702A, that you've got to have the knowledge that a weapon is being brought along and it's going to be used.
Well, tell us your version of the record. What
okay,
do you
my version of and just to go back to that question again about in the record, where is it about? When did he first see the gun? In his statement, he does say when he's being called up to help with the items, he says I wasn't going to argue with a man with a gun. Now the jury, I guess, could infer. That may be the first time he sees it. They may have some other way of interpreting that, but that's the only thing in the record as far as the jury sees about when does he see a gun. That's the only place. It's in his statement.
There's no prior discussion about showing him his father's gun, not offering it to him, just showing it to him.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So
I'm sorry. I thought you meant in context of that.
We're talking about
knowledge
of the gun.
Now, all right, on knowledge of the gun, and again, In the record, he is saying, and it goes back to a statement again. He's got three statements, the appellant does. You read each of those three, and you've pretty much covered what there is in front of the jury about the gun. And one of those statements, he says, we were talking about Ashford's days in the Army shooting. I was telling him about my family's sporting, hunting, that kind of thing, and I showed him this weapon. I showed him the gun. So you've got that.
Not in the context of talking about to go get these drugs.
No. No, because...
Okay, and then sometime later, the next mention in the record of the gun is when he says, I'm not going to argue with the man that has a gun.
Yes, and again, that's his statement. So all of that is just coming from the different statements he gave to the police. Now, the only thing I would add, and first of all, I apologize, I don't know these latest cases that the state cited on the hearsay. I would say, number one, the search warrant was based on Ashford's father telling the police information he'd gathered from Ashford, not from Gray's father.
Okay.
Okay? So that's one thing. The other thing is, while the statements to his father do not come in like as a prior consistent statement or something like that, I recognize that they are consistent. It simply elaborates, though, on his statements that were given to the police about how in fear he was, and in more detail about the gun when he saw it, his lack of knowledge, that sort of thing. So that's why that's important, because it puts forth really his defense of lack of knowledge.
So you're saying optional completeness?
No, I wouldn't say optional completeness. I'm just leaving it as is, as an excited utterance. Okay, that was my take on it. And yes, I understand it is a big burden that any defendant has when he's not testifying to be able to get a statement in. But this statement, if you look at it in the context of, is it inculpatory or exculpatory, it's both. And I think the police would have been darn glad to have that statement that he gave to his father. They would have been glad to have that for themselves. It put him as a guilty party to a robbery in which people died. So certainly there's some guilt there. And then he's also saying, hey, I didn't know about this gun. So he's limiting it as well. I see that. But it's both inculpatory, exculpatory, from that point of view. I think that was all I had on that point. Thank you.
Mr. King, thank you. Ms. Kennedy, thank you, too. Court appreciates both of you appearing this morning to present your arguments. They're both well done. Interesting case. Case is submitted. We'll ask the clerk to adjourn us for the day.